Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
I really learned a lot of winemaking from a Pinot Noir winemaker that we had, and we had this brand called La Rochelle.
Oh, yeah.
And Tom Stutz, you know, looked at winemaking on the Pinot side in a way that we started using for Cabernet. So there is for me an idea that, you know, that there is a, you know, sort of a this weightiness that we want to have, but that it's not burdensome.
Yeah.
You know, you want to have a sense of heft in your mouth, but you want to have it in such a way that it kind of dances. You know, dances along this acid river again in your mouth, as it were.
There's that analogy. I'm actually really impressed that Lineage wasn't trademark otherwise, that you were able to get
me
that.
Me too. It is trademark now. but yeah, I was surprised as well that it you know, it's a word that exists obviously in everyday language, but it's certainly descriptive of our experience.
No, I think it's very apropos, and it's a very regal looking bottle. We talked about folks really looking at labels closely for their purchasing decisions. I would say it's one of the cleaner, more attractive labels that I've seen. So
thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's taste it.
Yes. I've been very disciplined. I've been staring at this bottle for the last 2 hours. And believe me, it wasn't
I
was, too
I
easy.
I would have been happy to pop that cork.
Oh, no, we were so involved in the conversation, and this was a great backdrop. This is really a culmination of everything that, you know, you as a human and as a winemaker, I think, want to express. Isn't that
it
correct?
Is indeed. It is indeed. And this is kind of a neat little juxtaposition of where we are as a winemaking family right now in terms of the things that we're trying to present to people, you know, and the ways that you know, the next generation can get a handle on, you know, their journey through the wine business, which is hopefully going to be a very long and fulfilling one, just as it has been for me so far.
So this wine was born, what was the first vintage?
2007.
Okay, this has been going on for a while.
Yeah, so we're 2015 we're out of now. We made it was a short harvest for us in 15. We had that rain issue and right during flowering that really knocked a bunch of yields way down. And 12 we made more of and have a little bit in our library. And I really like the way this vintage is moving forward. This is 72% Cabernet, 14% Cab Franc, 10% Merlot, and 4 or 5% Petit Verdot. So it's a little more Cabernet dominant than 13 and 14 were. And 16 was 59% Cab. 17 will end up probably being something like 50% Cab. So Cabernet Franc plays a very important role in our winemaking. It's that element, I think, that adds acidity and that adds elegance to the wines. It's the sexiest grape out there, in my opinion. You know, so it adds something to the blend that only it can add as a variety. And it differentiates us from Napa Valley in a way. You know, most of the high-end blends there don't have as much Cab Franc in them as Lineage tends to have.
You know, you mentioned blending as obviously an art form. That's where you really get to express your vision. There's obviously, maybe not infinite, but quite a few possibilities. What dictates the blend, obviously, besides the vintage? You know, and how the cab shows up, which is the main component. Why the variance in percentages? What's in your mind when you're putting it together?
That's a great question. So, so kind of the overarching vision, again, getting into, you know, just sort of the way that I think, I guess, is, you know, we're making this beautiful beast.
Beautiful beast. Skeleton
is Cabernet Sauvignon. The fleshiness is Merlot. The electricity, the sex appeal, the joie de vivre is Cabernet Franc. And then you get the sort of exotic coloring that can come from Petit Verdot and Malbec. And that's a little bit of the blend. We start by tasting through all of our Cabernet, different cab, different vineyards that we have, different clones. So we harvest everything separately, make it separately. And we go through and just taste and evaluate the inherent quality of every lot.
Yeah.
Pick out what we think is lineage worthy, and then get down to single barrel choices. Yeah. And we do everything blind. So we're not looking at individual coopers. We're not looking at, you know, this vineyard, we have to have X percent of this and Y percent of that. In fact, we're blending 17 now, and I was, we had done some heated ferments on a couple different lots of Cabernet, and tasted them in barrel, one, you know, in fermenter, and then in barrel, mm-hmm. at, just after harvest of 17. And said, these wines are gonna be amazing, mm-hmm. stunning, absolutely lineage, blah, blah, blah. And they ended up being like number 4 and 5 in my list of 6 of the vineyards that actually ended up working. They did, individual barrel components did make it into the blend, at least as the blend it sits right now. But that's one of the wonderful things about being, you know, making wine is that you're often fooled, or not fooled, you're often surprised, mm-hmm. in a good way when you don't let your preconceptions about barrels or vineyards get in the way. You taste mm-hmm. blind and just evaluate the wine on its merits. And so once we get through a Cabernet base that we really, really like, we'll start blending in varying percentages of Cab Franc and mm-hmm. Merlot, and then we'll kind of layer these things in until mm-hmm. we get to a point where we say, yeah, that's all the edges are off the rock now. This is what the, and it's 60, 80 different mock blends ultimately that we kind of get through until we get to that. That's the one.
Those blending trials have to be fun and brutal.
Oh, 99% fun.
Well, you know, we kept talking about the fruit and like the sweeter characteristics throughout the conversation, and that of course conditioned my head that this wine would have a certain degree of austerity. Last time I tasted your wine, I believe, was 3 years ago.
I think so.
And I remember it being actually really complete. I remember it being very balanced, and, you know, just a great composition of structure, texture, acidity, all the good stuff. This is my second foray into this bottling, and I'm so charmed by the fruit. It's kind of, you know, it's messing my mind up a bit.
Good. You're already far enough down the path, I don't worry about you. No, that's the way it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a different experience, you know, and it is, it's an interesting thing, you know, that it, there's no way to tell exactly how a bottle of wine is going to evolve. Mm-hmm. And a bottle of wine is just one bottle of wine out of a bunch of bottles.
Sure.
You know, they say that, you know, for old wine, there's no great old wine, there's just great bottles. And this is still a very young wine, but this wine has still a lot of baby fat to it in a way. You know, it's relatively low in alcohol. It's just barely 14%, I think. 13.9, not even 14%. So there's a long way for this wine, for the acidity that's kind of inherent in mid-palate to finish in this wine to kind of do its work and pare things down again.
Yeah.
Although I agree, you know, 12 on occasion has been a little bit more austere for me. We don't tend to filter these wines, so there's a little bit of bottle variation. But the aromatically, the wine's really neat and it's very supple in the mouth.
Oh, come on, say it. It's sexy as
it
hell.
It is sexy as hell. It is pretty beautiful.
No, you can't walk around this.
Well, good. It's easier if somebody else does. Yes.
No, this is a sex bomb. I mean, there's no.
Thank you.
No two ways about it.
I'm really happy with the way this wine's evolving. I almost chose 11. And 11's a very different vintage. And a really neat year, a really hard year for winemaking. That was really kind of the last year that we had.
It tested you, didn't it?
Yeah, yes, in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Bad weather kind of all throughout the year, very cold, rainy at harvest. We had to declassify a lot of wine, but we ended up with a wine that I think is showing absolutely stunningly well right now. And it's not as expansive. This is like a golden retriever, you know, this particular wine, or like an eye. It's just, this is a wine that just kind of licks your face all over.
I was thinking a pinup girl, but now I have this image of this dog that can't wait to lick your face.
Yeah, maybe it's a bikini wearing lab or something.
Yeah.
But there. Oh God, that's
no, that's, I'm not sure where to take that.
This is 11 is
memorable. I'll say that.
Yes, 11 is more like 11's maybe a little bit more, at this point in his life, a little bit more serious, a little bit more, serious is not really exactly the right word. It's just a little more buttoned up, let's put it that way.
Yes, it's a little more formal and maybe doesn't give up a whole lot, kind of Catholic school girl.
As opposed to yes, bikini clad Labrador.
You know, I heard from various winemakers that 11 was the vintage they try to complain to Bordelais about, but nobody at Bordeaux had any empathy because they have vintages like that all the time,
every other one.
But here we just, this is such an event because it was such an outlier, wasn't it?
It was, and those are the kinds of vintages actually from a winemaking standpoint you kind of have fun with because they're the major wine presses always, and I guess they have to in a way, but they're always quick to rush to judgment about the quality of a vintage.
Of course.
And the 11s are showing beautifully, just kind of across the board.
Yes.
And they're of a different style. They are more austere. They are more, in our case in a way, a little bit more acid driven.
Yeah.
They're not as friendly.
Yes.
As this particular wine is, for instance. But they hold secrets that you can tell that this is someone you want to get to know because every time you meet them, there's going to be some revelation that just, you know, your jaw drops a little bit. You know, there's, holy cow, I didn't know that about you. I didn't know, and that's kind of how those 11 vintage wines are to me now. You know, this now, what, eight years past vintage now?
Yeah.
And youthful still. Very kind of, like you say, buttoned up is a really good word. A good way of saying they're buttoned up, but with tremendous amount of promise. There's a lot of stuff hidden, you know, behind there.
It reminds me a little bit of 98 that was panned by the critics as well, in that typical fashion, baby with the bathwater, because the vintage is not so advantageous in one specific region doesn't have anything to do with the rest of California. And yet, and specifically mountain fruit wines fared so well in 98. Yep. I mean, I have some in my cellar and they're impressing, you know, knocking my socks off, quite frankly. But 2011 is a poster child for misunderstanding. It's just a different functionality.
Totally agree. And not, you know, one of the things that's great about Bordeaux, and if I were making Bordeaux, I'm sure I'd feel differently about this, but as a consumer of Bordeaux, It the wine is interesting in part because it is different every year, and generally substantially different from year to year.
Yes.
California does not have those variabilities. It that's what makes it a joy to be in California from a, you know, just a living standpoint.
Yeah.
But from a winemaking standpoint, you know you're generally not going to have to deal with a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
Now, you know, who knows with global warming and climate change, how that might affect things, and we're seeing those changes in terms of the start of the season and that kind of thing. The weather here is very odd. You know, it ought to be 65 degrees out and sunny right now. You know, we're you know, getting toward the middle of March already, and you know, it's cold in the mornings. It's been rainy kind of nonstop for the last 3 weeks, and it's reminds me of 98 in that way too. You know, that kind of, I think there was an El Nino that year and there was a lot of rain too. We'll see how it works out.
Well, obviously, do you still have inventory of 2011 before I move on?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
And the price point?
I think it's $185.
You know, we'll talk about this in a moment, but honestly, those folks that are listening that are really inclined to age the wines. And I know we don't have a whole lot of culture in this country of aging. Mm. I know we drink wines, you know, we age them in the backseat of the car. I get all that.
Exactly.
But if you're so inclined, I would recommend, and please talk about this for a minute, 2011 is a vintage, and specifically your bottling, I think would blossom in the cellar and would deliver so much. You will be well rewarded for your $185 or whatever it is that you choose to buy.
Absolutely. I can't wait to drink the 11 vintage 10 years from now, 15 years from now. I think it's just going to be one of those. It appeals to me, again, maybe call it a vanity, kind of in a certain way.
It's okay. It's a good wake-up call.
It was a harder vintage to make. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, most vintages in California, if you're reasonably competent, you're going to make good wine.
Yeah.
It was a show-off year in a way. If mm-hmm. you made really good wine in 11, it was because you cared and you had an idea about what you were trying to accomplish, and you did it. That's one aspect of it. But even more to the point for me personally, I love that style of wine. Yep. I want more austerity. Yep. I want more hidden. I want it's an iceberg wine in a way. You know, nice. All of the, you know, 80% of all that's great is hidden below the surface. Perfect. And that will only be revealed with time. And I think that there's a lot of time ahead of it to reveal. I was at my granddaughter's fourth birthday party yesterday, Saturday. She was born in 2015. A year that for us is kind of an odd year, mm-hmm. As we talked about earlier, but overall a really good vintage for California. Mm-hmm. Great vintage for Bordeaux.
Short, right?
Short mm-hmm. though. But, you know, we're going to have wines for her that will be perfect when she's 21 from that vintage, you know, that it's not something necessarily set out to do, but just the style of wine that I like to make and that I like to drink lends itself to ageability.
Absolutely. And there's no price point resistance when it comes to Bordeaux. And I would argue that for, you know, blue chip California wines, there's a full acceptance of the price points.
I think so. There ought to be anyway.
With respect to Livermore, you kind of set a precedent, didn't you?
We always have. I mean, when we released the first vintage of Stephen Kent Cabernet in 1999 from the 96 vintage, it was $45, mm-hmm. which I think at that point was kind of double what anything else had been priced. And for us, the price point is, it's really a belief in the quality of the wine that we have. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always felt like, you know, Livermore Valley can produce wine the equal of Napa in quality. Why should we sacrifice price? Mm-hmm. Just because we're Livermore Valley. We tasted a lot of wines from Napa in 96 and, mm-hmm. you know, and the vintages surrounding that before we finalized our price on Stephen Kent, mm-hmm. and did the same thing with Lineage. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, you know, I buy my share of Harlan and share of these other wines that, you know, are $800 a bottle.
Right.
And that equation of this bottle is, you know, not, you know, this bottle is certainly better than one-fifth the price or whatever. That kind of equation doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that with a small bottle, with 200 cases of wine produced, there's a scarcity aspect to things. But more inherently than that, there's a quality aspect of things that, mm-hmm. that is, you know, if consumers will allow themselves to entertain the idea that great wine can come from other places mm-hmm. besides Napa, and they have an opportunity to try this wine, or they will take a flyer based upon our conversation.
Yeah.
I have a pretty confident idea that they're going to really enjoy what they get. So I've always been up for the challenge. Always been, you know, it's part and parcel of you know, kind of the DNA of our brands is.
Yeah.
You know, we know our place in the world right now from a consumer and critical standpoint. Mm-hmm. We don't believe that's the proper place, though. You know, we believe mm-hmm. that we should be up here and not where the world seems to think that Livermore Valley wine should be.
Kudos to you. It always takes a pioneer. Again,
you get a lot of arrows coming through the door.
Yes,
first,
no,
right?
you okay. are the tall puppy, but the thing right. is, if your wine delivers, it really is not a dollar proposition, because clearly you that can't afford it, period, or when you're able to make that purchasing decision,
right,
then you have tons of options.
Right.
And what you're communicating is that my option delivers consistently with this soil, with my vision, and its value.
Right.
For that price point.
Absolutely. No question. I stand by it 100%.
Well, let's talk about the flavor profile for a second, because I just can't help myself. And it's
you
got
tell
so
me
many layers.
Getting, yeah.
Oh my goodness. It's first of all, the complexity. There's a lot of really luscious fruit. But there's also a lot of savory notes, a lot of tobacco mm-hmm. leaves, a lot of earthy notes. Mm-hmm. Beautiful texture.
Thank you.
The textural element to me is absolute key, because that's what kind of sits on your tongue.
And that's the thing we have most control of as winemakers. So I'm thankful that you're enjoying
it. No, it's
of
velvety. And it has so much presence, both aromatically and palatally, but it, again, what you described, it doesn't overpower.
Right.
Even though it's, you know, when you look at somebody that's really beautiful, you know, you want to keep staring at them. But if they're overt in right. how they present themselves,
right.
then you kind of just get sick of it,
right?
So this wine is a stunner.
Thank you.
But it does have this elegance.
Thank you.
Even though it's a big, big wine, you know that, and it's still a baby, I feel like I'm committing infanticide a little bit.
Well, I mean, you know, today anyway, yes.
But it is such a giving wine. It's such a generous wine that, you know, it's so delicious to drink and release. In this particular case, unlike with 2011, we clearly could very easily get into it and finish the bottle
and
lick our chops.
No question.
And not even think about laying it down.
Right.
And that's what I adore about this. I'm a believer in cellar-worthy wines, don't get me wrong. But when it comes to pleasure, I'm all in.
I agree 100%. People will often ask, you know, when should we drink this wine? When we buy this wine, when should we drink this wine? It's a really hard question actually to answer, because it's very much at the base a personal decision. Because, you know, wines age, they change. What you like as a consumer, you like as a consumer from a flavor and texture standpoint. It's not just a simple drink it in 5 years kind of a situation. There's probably for me the favorite word that we've heard, whether it was you or me or both of us, it's a generous wine.
Yeah.
It wants to make you feel good. You know, it wants to be delicious. You know,
yes.
It wants to appeal to that just golly, this tastes really, really good kind of aspect of things. I can remember, and I was thinking about this, it kind of popped in my head as we were talking, don't know exactly why, but I think that you know, one of wine's jobs is to be delicious. I think that as much as I'm interested in intellectual
exercise
as far as wine is concerned, I think that ultimately wine should taste good. I remember watching a special on El Bulli restaurant, you know, I think it was Anthony Bourdain's last show on that particular restaurant. And it was voted the greatest restaurant in the world for many years, and Ferran Adria, the chef there and the owner, made a point to say that, you know, some of these courses are not supposed to taste good, necessarily.
Wow, that's
they're supposed
a scary
to be
to
about
hear.
Right,
when you're
which is a very interesting thing. It's supposed to be about texture in this case.
Yeah.
Or it's supposed to be about this. Supposed to be using all of your senses.
Yeah.
And I think of I equated that at the time that I saw it with sort of the natural wine movement, with the idea that, as a winemaker, I don't do anything.
Right.
Which I love the conceit behind it. I love the idea that
it's so counterintuitive.
It is counterintuitive. And when it works, it's beautiful. And I love the idea of, you know, of taking care of your vineyard in such a way that you can marshal the sort of cosmic forces, as it were, to deliver beautiful fruit every year, to take care of this piece of land that you have and not add a bunch of chemicals and stuff. I totally get that and understand it and sympathize with it. And I hate the but part that might come after this. And if I were a younger man, I would never probably have the but. But I've seen a lot of stuff. I don't appreciate the idea that somebody makes decisions or lack of decisions, which are still decisions in the cellar, right? I'm not going to add sulfur. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to ameliorate the wine in any way. It is what it is. Wine is chock full of Brett. The wine's got VA. The wine's got whatever it has. I'm still going to ask somebody for their hard-earned money for something that really isn't palatable.
There you go.
That really isn't good. That really doesn't display any finesse or winemaking, and the idea that I still don't know what terroir means exactly.
I don't think anybody does.
I agree, but I do know one thing: that Brett overwhelms anything to do with terroir. You know, it's such a dramatic aromatic and flavor element that it overwhelms everything else that you might get from the wine, be it fruit or a sense of earthiness or whatever else you might, you know, sort of equate with terroir. And I've always found that to be a really irresponsible kind of a thing, is that you're I get to play chemistry set or lack of chemistry set. I get to throw a bunch of stuff together and squish it with my feet and do all this stuff that appeals to my you know, that winemaker's sense of vanity.
Yeah.
And ask somebody, the consumer can choose not to pay. I get that part too. Mm-hmm. But the idea that you're going to give something that's fundamentally flawed to somebody, it doesn't sit well with me.
No, and it became a marketing tool, which I resent even more because for the consumer, it's another layer of confusion. Thank you.
Right.
For adding that.
Right.
When somebody labels it, not even necessarily in written form, but they speak of natural wine. And wine doesn't make itself. Vinegar does.
Right. True. That's well said. there's at the same time, I mean, it's a complicated issue because I've had some really amazing experiences with wines that were just the weirdest thing in the world and so incredibly exciting because they were weird.
Yeah.
And you don't want to drink them every day, certainly. And you may never want to drink them again.
Yeah.
But you want to experience it one time. And that's, again, part of this sort of bottomlessness thing of wine that we were talking about before, that for every wine drinker, there's a different palate.
Yeah.
And for most wine drinkers, they'll find something they really cotton to, you know, emotionally as well as every other way.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing. And I'm not opposed at all to tasting somebody's failed experiment. Just don't charge me for it.
Yeah.
If you know it's failed, you know, and it's just, it's not, again, I go back to my sort of hospitality gene, and that's not a hospitable thing. It's not hospitable. It's not putting out the right pillow. It's not offering refuge to somebody, to ask them to take money out of their pocket for something that is fundamentally unsound. Fundamentally different, fundamentally flavor and structural profile that's unusual, hey, that's a whole different ballgame. That's really cool. And you can choose to like it or not like it. But, you know, so this, you know, idea that you want to be able to give people something that appeals to as many parts of themselves as you possibly can.
And
do it in a way that is responsible.
Right. And you want to deliver something complete, which I would argue the wines of, you know, the other nature are experiments, and by definition they're not complete. You would never put an incomplete dish as a hostess or host in front of your guests.
Correct.
That is hazardous and not tasty.
Right.
So why, you know, some people feel free to, provide this experimental stage and request that people support it is a bit beyond me.
Right.
And to me, it's a symptom of a bigger problem and, conversely, a greater solution. I think with the limited amount of resources that most of us have, both time and money-wise, I choose to support people that speak integrity to me, in addition to flavor profiles. So we're now talking about the nucleus of the issue, which is trust. When you're in front of that newly picked, very exciting, exhilarating vat, I know there's people around you, but in a way you're alone with your craft. The decision that you make will impact the rest of the process. And that's a very honest moment in my mind.
Oh, no kidding. There are, you know, when we're in the middle of harvest, you know, we're here at the winery very early, and there's nothing that I enjoy more than being alone with my fermenting vessels and having an opportunity just to slough off sales concerns, profitability concerns, partnership concerns, whatever else gets in the way of that specific moment, and just be with that thing, you know, just to listen to what's going on in the room. And if you've got 30 fermenting, barrel fermentation of Chardonnay going on over there, and you hear the pss, 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 you know, of the through the fermentation bung, and you see the, you know, stuff coming through and kind of dripping down the sides of the barrels, and you've got the, you know, you've got the sort of heaving cap of a red fermenter, and you can feel the heat coming off of the thing, and some caps dropped over here already, and it's a five senses kind of a experience, and especially if there's no forklifts moving around and nobody else sort of there, it's a really I'm not a religious person.
I was going to say, so it sounds like a religious experience. You took the word out of my mouth.
But it is kind of a sacred thing in a way. To, you know, from in my within my realm of work, it's one of those very sort of, you know, the beginning of the world kind of moments, you know, where you've got this connection to something that is at the start of its being.
Right, and it's you think about how babies taste everything with their mouth. Everything goes in the mouth.
That's right.
So you said this
this
was that moment.
That's right.
Where this is your primal and primary tool that you use.
That's right.
That's what you rely upon, and it's humbling.
It's awe-inspiring, to use your word again. There's something, you know, there's something just incredibly compelling about being in that environment. And
how 3D? How did you describe it? My goodness, I mean, it's so physical.
It is. I mean, it's the work part of it's physical. The just sort of being on a step ladder and digging my hand through 12 inches of Cabernet cap to get to some liquid, you know, and coming out with, you know, schmutz all over your arm, and, you know, and your hands are already dyed red from all the stuff, you know, for the, you know, previous 2 months. And I've got a little graduated cylinder in my hand, and I'm looking at it, and I'm smelling it, and I'm tasting, and I'm writing notes, and I've got little drips and stains all over my notebook from, you know, from all my note writing. And I've got, if I'm far enough down the road of fermentation, and I've got three bins from the same grape, let's say, of the same grape, three different yeasts, I've got three other graduated, you know, other beakers, and I'm taking a little bit, I'm taking a third from each bin to see what the composite might taste like if I press them all together. Well, these two bins are different, let me try those two. And so there's just, I'm thinking about what that wine is going to be like 3 years later when we find the bottle.
Cool.
It's such an amazing experience. It's just...
See, your eyes changed again. And see, I've been privileged to listen to stories like yours, and I don't get to get my hands all in it. The closest I've ever come to the physicality is through cooking, but
sure.
Most of us will never really come close to what you described. But you guys listening, what you just said is so important, because when that bottle of wine lands on somebody's table, it is the direct result of your hands, your brain, you know, complete immersion.
That's true. That's absolutely right. It's an honor to be able to give that to somebody, you know, and it's an honor to be able to do, you know, it's everything that we do every day, every morning. I'm there at 5 o'clock, you know, digging my hands through caps, and it's rainy and cold and outside and whatever else. Is all of that is in service to that perfect pillow. You know, that perfect, that idea of giving somebody something that enhances their life, that makes them feel better than they did before, that creates something, a wow moment or whatever. So just some kind of sharing between them and me, between the drinker and the maker. And that's a pretty awesome thing, you know, to be able to work in a field that allows for that potential relationship of that kind of, you know, chances are I don't ever get a chance to talk to them, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But just to know that somewhere in New Jersey, someone's got a bottle of Lineage and they taste it that night, and they go, and it goes, and it takes them on this journey, intellectual and emotional, and hedonistic, and to know I had a part in whatever it makes them feel is just really, it's just awesome.
You know, please know that as a listener, as a consumer, you're that very big part of the symbiotic cycle that starts with the land and ends on your table, on your convivial table, hopefully, that includes sharing. Because what you do and what you care about so deeply, and you verbalized it wonderfully, but I can also see it. That's who you are. You are the maker, in this case, a winemaker of a product that actually makes people's experiences, life experiences, more. You can have dinner, or you can have the dinner. You can have an exchange, or you could have a true, fundamental, transformational experience. And you're the facilitator, and that bottle of wine winds up through your hands on somebody's table, and there's no diminishing it, there's no discounting it, there's, you know, this joke, you know, winemakers, we don't sell lies, you know, we don't solve world problems. I would respectfully disagree. I think you contribute in a very powerful way to the mental health of those of us that have discovered the true benefit of this elixir that is unlike any other fermented substance.
Thank you. First, I don't ever apologize for earnestness. And some people, you know, they make fun of that kind of a thing. But I agree with you. I agree with you. I mean, there are a lot of other things that are much more important than a bottle of wine.
Right.
However, I think the spirit behind that, the wine's the vehicle. The wine's the vehicle for that emotional sharing, you know. And that's something that's incredibly important in any day and age, especially these days. You know, where there's so many divisions, and if through whatever hospitality, food, wine, whatever it comes, whatever I can be involved in, there's a small step made in a bridge to bridge a gap. I'll take that as a career. I'll take that as a noble effort to do good, as it were. Cheers.
No, it has a meaning. I will cheers to that. And I hope people that are listening will go out and buy a bottle of wine. My hope for you is that it would be what we're so fortunate in consuming right now. I know that not all of you would be able to, but this wine, by the way, is a chameleon. It's changed dramatically from even the last sip. I am blown away by the nose and the mid palate that we discussed, but also the finish. Mm. It keeps going and going and going and going. It's a hedonist bottled, or hedonism, I should say, bottled. It's pleasurable, it's absolutely age-worthy, it's luscious, it's delicious, I can't get enough of it. But for those of you that may not be able to partake, I would say that since you have such an extensive portfolio, I'm sure there's something you can find
that
would be a good introduction to this brand. And even if it's not yours, I know you would not object to me saying this, just go out and get a bottle of wine.
Not at all. Please, start the journey.
That's our wish for you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure
sharing
a glass and thoughts with you.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Thanks so much.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.